Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Vance must have told his aides to stick a knife in Pete Hegseth's back.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by The Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my partner in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies and an Atlantic contributing writer. Elliot, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I note that the two of us are broadcasting from our messy offices rather than our home libraries, which seem to be much better organized. I think your office may be a little bit messier than mine, but I think that's only because you've gotten to that point of overflowing books where you have to begin stacking them horizontally rather than vertically. I do that too, but I think you've gone further down that path.
I live by Einstein's adage, which se non è vero e ben trovato, that if a messy desk is the indicator of a messy mind, what is a clean desk?
All right. Well, I'm glad that we periodically give our listeners something, some kind of deep philosophical wisdom to reflect on.
There you go.
Okay. Moving from the sublime to the ridiculous, I think we should go to the jackasseries of the week. So my favorite jackassery was actually broken by the Bulwark's own Ben Parker, a beneficiary, I might add, of an extraordinary graduate education at your hand and mine. And this was the new passport. Now, members of my family are in despair because they were afraid that they would have to get this passport. Actually, you don't absolutely have to. It is one with a president, with a picture of President Trump. And I mean, it's so ridiculous. And, I am sure that there will be those kind of lickspittles and toadies and, mindless MAGA devotees who will be clamoring for this. I think most people will be retching and ordering it online, and you can avoid having the Trump passport. All you have to do is order it online or go somewhere other than Washington to get it. So you too can avoid this. The thing that struck me, of course, is that not only is this ridiculous and vain and un-American and un-Republican, it's also Trump seems to like this picture of himself, with that scowl, which is the kind of ticked off strongman scowl. Mussolini kind of went in for that, but he's not Mussolini. He's not a tough guy. This is a bone spurs guy. Mussolini at least was a serious combat veteran of the First World War. It's part of the bottomless childishness of this guy and the willingness of people in the bureaucracy. I'm sure the political appointees with the career people rolling their eyes to accommodate his ridiculous whims, which hopefully will make them all look ridiculous and shameful in years to come. That's my jackassery.
Yeah, this kind of cuts close to the bone for me because I actually have to renew my passport next year. And like your family, I was despairing of having for the next 10 years to have a passport with his scowling booking photo from when he was taken into custody in Atlanta and when he was booked for the indictment for trying to overturn the election results in Georgia.
But you really can't avoid it.
I can, right.
But by the way, the one other thing that is worthy of note is as soon as the administration found out that Ben had broken it, they immediately dashed to give the story to Fox so it presumably wouldn't look quite so stupid. but it still looks incredibly stupid. I think you're probably not allowed to draw a mustache. Or horns or fangs or something like that.
You can't deface your passport. It's probably
you can't deface your passport. Yeah, well, I'm checking with my diplomatic advisor here. Yeah. Says
don't deface your passport. It could make it invalid.
But seriously, for all those of you who are thinking of canceling all travel plans for the next several years, if you order it online, you'll get a perfectly normal passport.
Well, I know that we're going to, as you said last week, have to retire as Jersey, but I'm sorry, I have to go back to, my standard of Secretary Hegseth. Attentive viewers and listeners will recall that Secretary Hegseth, after a couple of overzealous young pilots flew their helicopters in the vicinity of third-rate MAGA celebrity, Kid Rock, his home in California. They were about to be disciplined, but Secretary Hegseth rescued them and vacated that. But not content to undermine good order and discipline in the chain of command, he invited Kid Rock to Fort Belvoir, where he and Kid Rock flew helicopters with some of the young pilots there. You just can't. It beats out my other favorite, which is the White House troll this week of sending out a picture of King Charles III and President Trump together with the headline, two kings. I mean, obviously trolling the likes of you and me. Good lowercase R Republicans as opposed to monarchists, but never mind.
Well, yeah, proof that they really are a juvenile bunch. By the way, I'm, a little bit taken back when you say third rate MAGA celebrity, because that implies that they're a first-rate or even second-rate MAGA celebrity.
No, it starts at third rate.
Oh, it starts at third rate and goes downhill. All right, but let's get serious now. Speaking of the Secretary of Defense, Pete Hegseth, you, I'm undoubtedly, because of your long government experience, have a much stronger stomach than I do. So you actually watched his congressional testimony this morning, and you had some interesting observations about it. Could you share those?
I have to, full disclosure, I couldn't watch the whole thing. I only kind of dipped in and out and then watched some outtakes on Twitter. First of all, this comes against a background in which I think Pete Hegseth may have kind of one foot on a banana peel here. Trump seems to be in a firing mood. He's fired a couple of different cabinet secretaries, a lot of speculation about who's next to be fired. There have been press reporting in The Hill and elsewhere yesterday that Hegseth is on very thin ice with the Congress, and certainly that showed up today. He was peppered with questions by both Republicans and Democrats about the firings of Navy Secretary Phelan and Army Chief of Staff Randy George, subjects we've touched on in previous episodes of Shield of the Republic. Once again, he has no real answer for this, or is unwilling to give the real answer for why he fired certainly Randy George. But he also, began the hearing by he's there as this is a budget hearing. He's there to ask the Congress of the United States to, authorize the appropriation of $1.5 trillion for the Department of Defense, some of it in the base budget, some of it in a reconciliation bill. But he began by saying the real enemy we're fighting in this time of war is not Iran. It's the enemy within. It's the, feckless, defeatist Democrats and rhinos who are criticizing, elements of this war, which does not seem like to me an auspicious way to begin your budget hearing, where you're asking these folks to give you a lot of taxpayer dollars. But he also basically declared, that we're just at the start of an endless war. I mean, he said there's all this criticism that we've been at war for 8 weeks, but people of my generation know that, in Iraq and Afghanistan, we were at war for a lot longer than that, and not to mention Vietnam. I can only imagine, Susie Wiles' reaction in the White House to have, you know, PXF ripping off this scab in public.
Yeah, as though those were good things. You know, I think last week you and I mentioned there was a story in The Atlantic, which I believe they actually said that the sources were aides to Vice President Vance, saying basically that Vance had been telling the president that the Pentagon is not being forthright with him about things like munition stocks. So I had a couple of thoughts about that. I'd be curious about yours. One is, you know, as you and I were discussing, there's such a thing as leaks, which are, you know, your adroit journalist has cultivated a source and they confide something. And then there are plants where they just dump stuff on you. Truth to tell, I tend to always err on the side of plants rather than leaks, because I think basically the way this town works is not a clever journalist, you know, has deep sources in an administration or, you know, I mean, every now and then you get lucky the way my boss, Jeff Goldberg, did, and you get invited onto a Signal chat you don't belong on. But really what it really is, and I think it's clearly in this case, is Vance must have told his aides to stick a knife in Pete Hegseth's back. And it's also designed, of course, to make Vance look good, because I doubt Vance is really excited about having to advocate for a really long war that of a kind that he has criticized. So I tend to think you're probably right. I also, you know, it's as I think is generally known, Dan Driscoll, the Secretary of the Army, is the most likely successor. He's a friend of Vance's. Hegseth would clearly like to fire him. Driscoll certainly does not want to be fired. So I think that would kind of reinforce the banana peel thing. I think the only problem is Hegseth does sort of know how to play to the audience of one. And I think that belligerence comes partly from roid rage. I mean, I don't know whether he's on steroids or not, but, you know, he is just clearly a very temperamental guy with very, very poor impulse control, very poor control over his emotions, who's just kind of bristling with hostility and insecurity. But I think it's also calculated to some extent, to the extent he can control it, in order to please Trump, that, you know, he's fighting in his corner. But I guess where I think I would agree with you is, I think if something goes badly, he is clearly the designated fall guy.
Yeah, no, that seems to be pretty clear to me. I mean, Vance, who as Jonathan last, our colleague JVL has pointed out, you know, is behind the scenes levying all these criticisms of the war. I mean, it's to the point where the president has publicly said that he knows that JD is not real enthusiastic about all this, you know, but he's pointing out to the press the fact that munition stocks are low and that's a problem. He's pointed out that, you know, the war has been more costly than people have realized, you know, the destruction to U.S. facilities in the region and to equipment, you know, may, according to NBC, be as much as, you know, $5 billion worth. You know, it's a variety of things that he's pointed to about a war that he totally, completely supports because the president is really smart and all of his predecessors were dumb, as he said in the Oval Office. So, you know, he's playing in one sense, a kind of very dangerous game. And it, clearly this is a reflection, I think, of his concern about where this puts him in terms of 2028 as a potential successor to Trump. And he can't be totally kind of insensitive to, you know, the chatter that you see constantly that Trump keeps polling people about who would be a better successor in 2028, Vance or Rubio, and the winner of that straw poll appears to be overwhelmingly Rubio. So,
yeah, and I have to say this, I'm not an expert on domestic politics. I find it hard to imagine that this ploy really works, because you're clearly, you know, you are planting or leaking, whichever you prefer, enough to probably tick off people in the White House, the president or the chief of staff. But I suspect at the end of the day, it's not enough to actually put serious daylight between yourself and the president when it actually comes to a campaign. And, you know, what I know,
you might want to put a footnote there to, you know, see for further evidence, see Hubert Humphrey, Kamala Harris, you know.
Well, yeah. And then I would reach even deeper into the past and say, read Henry IV, part two. Usually the dying king does not want the crown prince to succeed, really. Doesn't really think that they're up for it. And so I think as Trump comes to the end of his term, I'm not sure that he's going to be that enthusiastic about Vance. You know, and I would also say that Rubio, who I think is a much smarter politician, has just been silent.
Right. He's been, with the exception of a brief appearance over the weekend, I guess, on the Sunday shows or on some interview, I'm not sure which, he's been largely absent from all of this, including from the diplomacy. I mean, when's the last time you can recall a serious diplomatic effort to end a war in which the delegation was headed by the vice president of the United States?
Well, or the president's real estate cronies. I mean, and his son-in-law. Speaking of the war, I mean, I think there has been in a way an answer to the question that you and I were discussing last week, which is, you know, what direction do we think Trump will go? And it does sound as though he has made a decision. We're going to continue the blockade. There are these stories that the Iranians are now kind of basically looking for every Jerry can and bathtub,
for oil storage.
Still not clear to me how much damage is actually done to these wells if you shut them down. Maybe they can manage it, maybe they can't. But it certainly does seem as though he's made a kind of a considered decision that the pain is going to be greater for Iran than for him. And as I think I was saying last week, I think it makes sense. I think he's processed that he's going to lose the midterm. I don't think he cares. Gasoline at $4 a gallon, that's not good, but that's not bringing mobs out into the street. On the whole, I think he's probably looking and saying, yeah, we are exporting a lot of oil. We're going to export a lot more oil. That's a good thing for the United States. And I don't quite know what the word fungible means. And so therefore, I'm not going to pay any attention to the economists who tell me oil is fungible. And I could go on, but I think that is the course that we're now embarked on. And so it'll be a test of wills. There's one other kind of really interesting thing, which is that Mojtaba Khamenei's picture apparently appeared on I don't know if you saw this story, on one of these giant wall posters that they have, which had a tribute to all our martyrs, which may indicate that, you know, he's succumbed to his injuries and that he's still silent. And it is pretty clear, I think, that there is, you know, again, occasionally lawyers tell the truth. I think Trump was probably right that there is chaos in the upper reaches of the Iranian government, that it's nobody has a real lock on Iranian policy. And so he is probably genuinely frustrated that there is not an interlocutor. I mean, I think he would prefer that. But there isn't one, at least. So those, I think, are all significant developments. There are other developments we can talk about in a moment, but let me just pause there and see if you have any.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're in for at least a period of, you know, no war, you know, no peace. You know, the quote ceasefire is going to continue along with the blockade. He's made that clear that that's his preference. He does have options for resumption of kinetic military activity. I think by some estimates, we now have almost twice as much combat power in the theater as we did when this kicked off on February 28th. So he does have the option of returning to kinetic, activity if he chooses to do so. And there's some voices clearly from outside, Lindsey Graham, Mark Levin, others that are calling on him to do just that. I think he thinks he has kind of on the fly worked out in his own head that, as you said, the Iranians will ultimately crumble and blink first, because not just the oil storage issue, that's important, obviously, but also the blockade keeps them from earning foreign exchange. It was the collapse of the currency that led to the public uproar in December and January that, you know, caused the regime to, you know, sort of falter a bit. There's a food issue, but, you know, how much, I mean, they can switch to the Caspian to bring in food from Central Asia, but can they replace all the food that comes in through the Gulf?
90 million people.
Yeah, for 90 million people, it's not clear. So, I mean, I think he thinks he's been persuaded that he has, you know, the advantage. The Iranians, for their, and he thinks he solved the one problem that the Iranians think advantages them. I mean, the Iranians think that he has shown, and he has, that he's very sensitive to the price of gasoline and to the market movements, both with regard to the price of oil and with regard to the, you know, broader markets, the stock market in particular. And, you know, there he has, I think, convinced himself that he has, you know, tamed the markets with his well-timed interventions, claiming this or that, whether it's that the regime is about to collapse, or that we're very far along to an agreement, or they're about to agreement, or they're begging for us to come and talk to them, whatever it is, most of which, you know, appears just before the New York Stock Exchange opens.
Yeah, but I mean, can't you argue that it's been
successful? Yeah, no, I was just going to make that point that, you know, to me, it looks like the market's seriously underpricing the risk. I mean, at the start of this, people were talking about oil going to 150 a barrel, 200 a barrel. It sits around 110 as we talk. So I think he feels he has, you know, mastered a methodology for, you know, forestalling the worst. Now, the question is, for how long can that go on before the market adjusts, you know, to maybe a more realistic expectation about what the risk is? There's another factor here, which is that's, you know, I think conditions some of the timing here, which is I think he very much wants to go to Beijing to meet with Xi Jinping on May 14th. And I think he thinks he can go on for at least that long, because it's not clear that it would be possible for the Chinese to receive him if kinetic military activity were, you know, underway. So he said just today that I much prefer, you know, the blockade. I think it has more influence on them than bombs. But I think with him, as with every, you know, with everything else, this is like a provisional judgment. And he knows he has the option to go back to kinetic activity, you know, when he chooses to do so. Although I believe the Gerald Ford will be coming home relatively soon, because it's been out on deployment for over 300 days. And at some point, you know, you really start to have serious morale and broader recruiting and retention issues in the U.S. Navy if you keep it out there indefinitely.
Yeah, although I will, friends and relatives who've been in the Army, you know, and had 12-month, 13-month, 14-month tours.
Rotations, yeah.
In Iraq go, yeah, a year is really a huge issue. So I don't comment on that. I haven't had to do that myself, but I just report that. You know, just on the markets, whatever it's worth, I was talking to one of our donors who's at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, who's a very, very wealthy man in the world of finance, and, you know, whose assessment was that, you know, these market valuations don't make sense. And I asked him, you know, why are things so high? And he says that he thought a lot of it was algorithms, that there's a lot of algorithmic trading that's going on. And we have seen that before. You know, we've seen crashes where all of a sudden the algorithms turn around, and people who've been making these bets on, you know, various quantitative kind of assessments, rather than underlying business conditions and value and all that. I don't know. That world is foreign to me, but again, it's just something that I report. In any case, I think he is. I think what we're seeing now is that he intends to persist. I'll stick by my judgment from last week that he's thinking about history with a capital H. He's thinking about his legacy, although he wouldn't use that word. And I think he sees resolving this issue not in the way that he saw, say, the Gaza War, which is, I'm just going to fix this and, you know, then move on to the next thing. I think this has probably become something bigger than that. Maybe it was always bigger than that. I don't know. But I think that picture is getting to be a little bit clearer. There was another thing that happened this week, which we should talk about, which is the United Arab Emirates leaving both OPEC and OPEC Plus, which I guess includes Russia. And, I mean, you can talk a bit about the background of it, but it seems to me it's evidence of the way in which wars kind of scramble things and break things loose. And some things remain the same, but a lot of other things, there are second and third order knock-on effects, and this is one of them. Does that make sense to you as an interpretation of what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, war can be, you know, very clarifying about, you know, sort of underlying, you know, tectonics in geopolitics, and I think you're seeing that play out here. Look, I mean, there are a couple of things to be said here about the UAE. So first, the sort of divergence of views between the Emiratis and Saudis, who a decade ago or so went to war together in Yemen, the differences have been brewing for some time. So this is a culmination, not a beginning of something in a sense. I mean, the Emiratis have, for some time had a greater and greater capability to extract hydrocarbons, and have chafed under the quota system that OPEC has used to maintain prices because it's kept the volume they can pump down, or they can sell down. But moreover, you know, what's happened here is, you know, you can see it in sort of the way the war has played out. I mean, the Emiratis have disproportionately been hit by the Iranians. And the effort they had made, their policy, which was a foreign policy of, you know, by and large alliance with the United States, and they were the pioneers, let's recall, in the Abraham Accords with Israel back in 2020. That's, you know, been a policy that was balanced by also, you know, keeping lines open to Iran and also to China. Underpinned by kind of the infrastructure they were building in Dubai and Abu Dhabi to some degree, but making Dubai a hub for finance, tourism, travel, and all of that is in shards now after the, you know, Iranian attack. And so, you know, Dr. Anwar Gargash, who both of us know, who is a senior advisor to MBZ, has said publicly, you know, look, this is, we're now aligned with the two powers that we see as most powerful in the region, the United States and Israel, and we're aligning ourselves that way. The Saudis clearly are still not there, and they and want a diplomatic solution to this, whereas the Emiratis are saying, you got to get rid of this regime in Iran. We can't live with this anymore.
But by the way, Gargash is a very formidable guy.
I agree with that.
Yeah, I mean, I've had conversations with him, and you know, you're clearly dealing with a first-rate foreign policy intellect. I would add a couple of things to that. One is UAE has thought more than Saudi has about alternative energy sources, so they've invested in nuclear. They have invested in a pipeline that bypasses the Straits of Hormuz. It's, you know, doesn't have enough to make all this go away. It's now been reported, I think it was in the Wall Street Journal, but I may be wrong, that the Israelis deployed forces there together with Iron Dome batteries, and they're willing to be public about that. The last thing about the Emiratis that I find fascinating, this really struck me on my last trip there, is they don't look north or even east and west, other than the extent that they really have to. Where they look is they look south. you know, and they look out to India and they look out to Africa. These are trading states. They've been in that line of work for hundreds and hundreds of years. And so they are a different kind of kettle of fish. And they've, you know, they've done some very interesting things. So UAE introduced conscription. And the first thing they did is they had members of the royal families, serve. Now, I don't know under what circumstances they were, but they were making a point that, everybody's going to serve, including royalty. They are tightly controlled. They're not democracies, that's for sure. I mean, they are, you know, in many ways, they're a bit reminiscent of Singapore, you know, making some, allowances there. But I think it is interesting. It has shaken things loose. There was another thing that got shook loose this week, which I thought was
before we depart from UAE, let me just make one other point. Although they're very small, and when they went into Yemen, for instance, they had to use non-Emirati troops, you know, mercenaries to, and they've used mercenaries and other things as well. They also do have some formidable military capabilities. Yep. I mean, throughout Afghanistan, their special forces, which are very small but very good,
fought
side by side with our folk. And they, you know, they fly the most advanced F-16s.
And it's their pilots.
And it's their pilots.
I was going to say those. They have both air power and special operations forces.
This is why I think it was either Dave Petraeus or Jim Mattis, I can't remember which one, who dubbed the UAE Little Sparta.
Yeah, except Sparta wasn't rich, and these guys are rich.
Right.
But it's very much a sort of a plucky city-state feel to it. And you know, let's remember, it's actually in a way a confederation of states. Dubai does not have oil.
Right. It's got location.
It's got location. But they've done a lot with just location, location, location.
Yep.
And you have to admire it. So the other thing about the war that I thought was interesting was Chancellor Mertz, in a statement, my guess is he probably regrets, said, the United States is being humiliated by Iran. Trump reacted rather angrily to that. What I thought was striking about that was not that I don't think Mertz's judgment on that is correct, actually. It tells you something about European views, I think, and the extent to which the Europeans are still, even after watching everything that's been going on to their east, they don't quite know how to think about war.
Although, to be fair to Mertz, when this started, Mertz actually made some very, I think, you know, trenchant comments about
you know, yes,
we hope that the Americans succeed. This is a terrible regime. You know,
yes,
we'd all be better off if it was gone. And
yes,
also Europe has an interest in the outcome here.
Right. And earlier on, he said, look, you know, during the 12-day war, he said, look, the Israelis are doing our dirty work. No, I mean, I think the reason why this is interesting is not because it's not really a criticism of Mertz at all, because I think he's one of the more formidable European leaders, and he is presiding over a very substantial defense buildup, which is long overdue. I think that in general, advanced liberal democracies, including our own, of course, really have trouble thinking straight about a war. And when things don't go immediately the way everybody thinks they should or wants them to, they assume it's some kind of terrible outcome, as opposed to saying, you know, there are pluses, there are minuses, there are things you expect, there are things that happen that you don't expect.
I think there's one other thing going on here, which is, you know, this is, and this is a point you made to me earlier, actually, in our own communications, which is that this is what happens when, you know, you don't consult allies when you go to war.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
So there's that. There's still the overhang of Greenland, which, you know, had only barely been resolved when this kind of kicked off. There's no guarantee that he doesn't return to Greenland. He's made periodic comments. We really need Greenland. The Europeans are terrible. You know, they're horrible allies, blah, blah, blah. And then there's that. I mean, there's the fact that there's this constant criticism of the Europeans for not pitching in a war that, despite the fact that the alliance itself, at our demand, excluded any area outside of Europe because we didn't want to get dragged into France's colonial wars. You know, they're not obliged to do anything under Article 5. And he's demanding that they do things that the U.S. Navy won't do.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, no, so, look, you're, that's absolutely right. And, well, we, I mean, you and I have kind of beat them up about that. There is one good piece of alliance news, and that was the visit of Charles III, which seems to have gone off swimmingly. And, you know, I had a couple of thoughts about that. One is clearly Trump is charmed by royalty, and particularly the British royal family. But the other thing is, this is one of the few things, maybe the only thing, that the Brits are still really good at. And Charles personally is really good at, you know, carrying this sort of thing off with dignity, grace, humor, a serious message, to some extent, which he managed to deliver. I mean, it was really quite a bravura, a performance. I just wish there was, you know, they didn't have such an incompetent government. I wish they had a military still, you know, which they're really the, you know, demolishing brick by brick. But, you know, on the whole, it was a very good thing. And, you know, three cheers for the king.
Yes. And I would add one other thing, which is when you look at the substance of the king's speech, it was very, to the Congress, it was very deftly delivered. You know, a shout out to Magna Carta and the number of times it's been cited in U.S. Supreme Court cases because it establishes the philosophical basis for checks and balances on executive power, whether you're a king or a would-be king, as the White House tweet, you know, suggested. But also, you know, a defense of alliances and doing things together, which brought the, you know, Congress in a bipartisan way to its feet, for a standing ovation. So I think all of that, you know, I agree with you, you know, the king certainly deserves, you know, kudos for having very deftly managed this and having, you know, sent a pretty good message.
You know, you mentioned the standing O for the king. That together, and also the Hegseth testimony. Do you think Congress is beginning to recover anything like the beginnings of a backbone, you know, something that you might have seen in the Pleistocene age, you know, point you can point at it and say this, you know, this stiffening jelly over here will eventually become a spine?
I wouldn't go that far. But I would say that, that I was struck by a extremely strong and very well argued op-ed in the Washington Post by the chairman of the Senate Defense Appropriations Subcommittee and former Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell about the administration's continuing obstruction of military assistance to Ukraine, which called out by name and very explicitly some senior defense officials who have been guilty of this before. And I do think it's part of a, you know, a growing sense that Congress has let some of its responsibilities slip away, and its rights and, you know, its duties, obligations as the first, you know, as the Article One institution of the United States political system under the Constitution, you know, to provide oversight of the federal government. And I think the real test will be, you know, May 1st when the, you know, 60 days on the War Powers Act, which I personally believe is unconstitutional, comes up, and the administration, they has to be held to a vote. Now, there are a lot of dodges they can use to get around this, and traditionally Congress has allowed the executive branch to use any dodge that is convenient. One of which would be, well, we've had a ceasefire for, I don't know, what has it been now, 10 days or almost 2 weeks?
Right, so there's no more war.
Either there's no more war or we haven't hit the 60 days yet because we're not in combat. If the Gerald Ford starts to return home, the administration might say, we are withdrawing forces, which triggers the 30-day extension of the War Powers Act. But, I do think you're seeing – more discomfort, and particularly among Republicans on the Hill, because they were told this was going to be quick, this was going to be easy, it was going to be over. And, even under the best case now, this looks like it's going on for some time. And the Secretary of Defense just told them it's the beginning of an endless war.
I've got a feeling the Democrats will go to town with that. From the point of view of your average American, because Trump cannot really, and his subordinates choose not to articulate the reasons for it. Why should the American people support him? And this is one of the things that just baffles me, is the extent to which contemporary politicians just don't particularly feel they have to explain to the American people why they're doing anything that they're doing.
Well, I think the president's a little bit hoist on his own petard here, right? Because he keeps saying this is all about their nuclear weapons. But in June last year, after
they were obliterated.
So how could it be about nuclear weapons if we obliterated them? I mean, he's caught in a kind of a trap of his own making. Except for the kind of robotic performance he gave in his speech from the White House, which wasn't even from the Oval Office, behind a resolute desk as his traditional, I think he's had, real problems making the case. And if you look at the polling, it's brutal for him, because this war started with a lower level of support than any conflict that we've been in recent memory, at the below, kind of low 40% now. Now it's down to, low 30, high 20%, with something like almost two thirds in most polling basically saying we hate this war. And so, I think Hegseth's comments are only going to, excite, not just Democrats, as you said, criticizing, but a lot of the Republican right, which has been at odds with Trump over this, and hence Vance's discomfort, because his wing of the party basically is against endless wars.
Yeah. I have to say, maybe it tells you I'm a terrible person, I don't mind seeing Vance twist in agony on this one.
Don't blame you.
Yeah.
One other thing. I know you were talking before we got started about some developments you've seen in Lebanon that, speak to the sort of changing character of war.
Yeah. So, the Israelis are conducting operations in Lebanon against Hezbollah, which is still around. Does say something about the resilience of Hezbollah and also the ability of the Iranians even now to support them. And I think the thing that's disturbing for the Israelis is Hezbollah is beginning to use fiber optic drones. So the Russians, I think, began doing this. Now Ukrainians have them as well. The key thing, basically, it's a drone where the guidance is going along a very thin fiber optic cable that stretches out, 10, 20 kilometers, which is an amazing thing to think about. And the reason why those are significant is you can't jam them. You can jam radio signals of one kind or another, do things with the drone's electronics. But against fiber optics, there isn't a whole lot that you can do, at least right now. And the Israelis have begun taking casualties from these things. The Telegraph had a very interesting video clip showing one of these things going right for an Israeli medevac helicopter. It ended up crashing before it hit the helicopter, luckily. But I think this is, you know, it is an indication of where war is these days. And there are a couple of things to take away from it. One is everybody gets to have an air force, including terrorist groups. And that, I think, is something. Secondly, that even if you have air superiority and all that, you know, there's now a deeper danger zone than there ever was, than there's ever been in the past. And, you know, it just makes war a lot more difficult, and lethal in a kind of a persistent way. And I think it's clearly having a psychological effect. You know, Israeli mental health, indicators for soldiers, like things like suicide and so forth, have been going up. Now, that's largely because they've been engaged in very intense warfare for almost, for 2.5 years now. But I think it's, you know, this is true for pretty much everybody else. And it's definitely true in Ukraine, which we, you know, we keep on saying we're going to talk about and we should, where, you know, the Russians are, we've discussed this. The Russians have taken major hits to their oil refining capability. But the other thing is, they really are getting pounded on the ground because the Ukrainians are operating at depth with unmanned systems. And I have to say, I do wonder if we're ready for this kind of war. I've got a feeling that in many ways the Ukrainians and to a lesser extent the Israelis are just having to adapt a lot quicker because they're really engaged in frontline combat in a way that we haven't been for some time.
No, I agree with that. And I think we've been very slow, for instance, but not just on, the mass use of drones, which, you know, we have them, but they're still, you know, very much a, you know, high demand, low density item in our kit. And counter drone, you know, which really only late in the Biden administration under, a directive from Lloyd Austin that there was an effort to actually do a lot on counter drone. And clearly it, had not percolated all the way through the system because, you know, one of the bones of contention in today's hearing, for instance, was the fact that our casualties, particularly the ones in Kuwait, by and large have come from drones and our folks really, you know, lack, a lot of counter drone capability. You're right to point out, you know, the strikes on Russian, not just oil refining, but, you know, we've talked about in the past in the Baltics going after the oil terminals, some of which has really kind of impeded Russia from getting the full benefit of higher oil prices. So, you know, one of the things that I think the war in Iran has done, which is unfortunate, is that it's kind of occluded people from looking at anything else. And there's still a lot of other things around the world that we ought to be looking at. Certainly what's happening with Russia and Ukraine is one of them. I mean, it's the results of the last several months. This was going to be Russia's vaunted spring offensive as the weather turned better, have not been particularly good. And again, as you and I were discussing earlier before we came on, you know, there's some interesting criticism of Putin that's coming up, you know, including an interview with his goddaughter, Ksenia Sobchak, in which the interviewee was talking about how much everybody around Vladimir Putin in his own entourage hates him and can't wait till they get to the post Putin era. I can't imagine that hasn't, you know, set off some kind of alarm bells, you know, inside the Kremlin.
At the bare minimum, awkward looks on Thanksgiving. I think what I'm struck by is you are beginning to see more and more reporting from people like Paul Gobel and others who are following Russian press and Telegram channels of people openly saying that the economy is in really serious trouble, that the demands that Moscow is putting on the regions are just cannot be met, that people really are sick of the war. You know, I think the difficulty is going to be, you know, for Putin, he's now on a bicycle. And if he stops pedaling, he's going to fall off and probably fall pretty hard. I mean, I don't, you know, we used to say that what he can do is declare victory and then go home. And I'm no longer quite sure about that. I just think they've gotten in so deep. They've taken such extraordinary levels of casualties, suffered such damage, that for him to say, okay, we've achieved my victory conditions, I just find that hard to believe.
Yeah, I mean, you know, people have been making the observation that Russia is now suffering from a huge labor shortage, which is damaging the economy because about 1.5 million people of working age, mostly men, fled, once this war broke out. And there have been 1.3 million casualties, which is, as you were saying, is, you know, absolutely astonishing. Well, just to tease the audience, I hope next week, in the spirit of covering things that people have, you know, let slip off their radar screen, our former colleague in government, Victor Cha, has a very interesting article in Foreign Affairs about North Korea, and I think you and I next week should devote some attention to it.
Yeah, we've been delivering too much good news recently. I think it's time to bring people down a little bit and talk about North Korean nuclear weapons. So,
yeah.
That should tantalize all of you out there listening to this.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
¿Quieres mejor internet? Cox Internet de 300 megas tiene las velocidades rápidas y confiables que buscas. Perfecto para streaming y gaming y trabajar desde casa. Yeah. Todo por solo $45 al mes cuando agregas Cox Mobile. Incluye equipo de Wi-Fi y garantía de precio de 2 años en tu plan. Yeah. No esperes. Cámbiate hoy a Cox. Requiere Cox Mobile Gig Unlimited. Garantía de precio no incluye impuestos y cargos. Velocidad de datos móviles se reduce después de 20 gigas al mes.